All right, Andy Stanley, great leader, great friend, all around great guy. Every time I hear Andy speak, I just get some great ideas and great stuff. And let's welcome the man from Atlanta, Georgia, Alpharetta to be exact, Andy Stanley.
Call you up in a minute. Well, the best part of coming to the C3 conference is just getting to sit over there for a couple of sessions, and I take two sets of notes whenever I hear Ed. There's the, what he's talking about and what I'm thinking about. Because, his ADD works for him and kind of gets over on the rest of us, because when you come here, there's always three things going on in your mind at one time because you're leaders, okay? Because leaders don't ever stay singly focused in an environment like this. They're listening, they're looking around, and then they're thinking about the future. So you leave here with sermon ideas. You leave here with the content of the conference. You leave here inspired. You leave here going, gee, my videos suck. But they're going to be better because I've been to the C3 conference. And you know, they're going to, hey, I got to do some shameless self-promotion for just a second. We're doing a series of resources with Multnomah for church leaders. And our newest one just came out. I'm so excited about this. It's called Creating Community. This is a book about our small groups model. And the reason I bring it up is because all of us are trying to do small groups. We've discovered some things. We've been doing them for 9.5 years. We do closed groups, which is unique. More and more of you are trying it. We would never go to open groups. We've been closed groups from day one. If you don't know closed groups from open groups, that's no big deal. But if you're a small groups person, you know the dilemma. So this is how we do closed groups. This is how we multiply. It's how we do group link. It's how we assimilate people into groups. And Bill Willits, our groups guy, actually wrote the book. They put my name on it because they think it'll sell better. So this is really Bill's book. But it's the lessons we've learned over the last 9.5 years about how to do adult groups. And so I'm very, very excited about this book. And if you're in groups ministry or you do adult groups, this is an extremely helpful resource. And again, it's a great tool. So, sir, since you got here, do you have this book already? You know, I was going to be really impressed if you already had it. No, there you go. There you go. See? Front row. Okay, did you have your note-taking outline? Everybody got the little deal called asking the right questions? As you know, the theme is questions. And when I read the theme, usually you do a conference, they give you the theme, and you think, gee, how can I take something I've already done and work it into that theme? Isn't that what you do, all you speakers? You go, oh, yeah, I'll tailor something. But honestly, I said I love the idea of asking questions because I ask questions all the time. And I want to talk a little bit about that. And so I sat down. And so I've never talked about this before, but I love this topic. And here's why. And if you don't hear anything else, hear this. Questions are an extraordinarily powerful tool in the hands of a leader. With one question, you can turn a meeting. With one question, you can influence a group. With one question, you can shut things down. Questions are extraordinarily powerful, and I want to talk to you a little bit about how to use them. But before we jump into this material, I can't talk about questions without saying this, and it's not in your notes. One of the smartest, one of the best things you can do as a leader is to let one or two, you don't want more than one or two, to let one or two of those obnoxious question askers into your inner circle. Now, you don't want 10 of them. But in your organization, there are some very, very smart people, and they get on your nerves a little bit because the whole field's going this way, and they ask a question, and everybody goes, ah! And you want to go, ah, oh, why did you have to ask that at this point? And I tell you what, you don't want to hide from those people forever. And one of the things I've learned, there's a couple of guys in our organization, in our church, they're not on staff, but laymen, real smart business guys, and they're kind of contrarian kind of guys. If everything's going this way, they're going, yeah, but. And now we got all the momentum this way, and they're still doing like this. Hey, have you ever thought about, and they kind of get on your nerves a little bit, but I'm telling you what, you got to have those guys in your inner circle. You don't want a bunch of them, but find the smart ones, the ones you know are squarely on your team, but they just, at the critical times, they lob in a question, and you find yourself a little bit irritated, but honestly, you're thinking, you know what, I hadn't thought about that. I'm telling you what, I'll never forget, we had just finished the plans for our first building. This is 9 years ago. And we're looking at the plans. We're so excited. We're going to build our first building. And we've been working for, you know, months and months and months. The architects, we had the architects at the meeting, had the contractor at the meeting, had the elders at the meeting, some of our stewardship guys at the meeting. And we're about to make the final decision. We've looked at the plans. We're going to build a worship center. And we're going to build half of our children's space, because who's got enough money to build the whole deal? And, you know, the whole thing. We're so excited. And this guy's name's Reggie. And Reggie Campbell, he's a guy that mentors me, and he's my go-to person for personnel situations. And he hadn't said anything the whole meeting. And I know Reggie. See, I can kind of hear him over there revving up. He's going to ask a question, thinking, "Oh, but just let us, you know, sign off on this." So I mean, we bought in. You know, everything's great. We're going to build our first building, and just before we vote, Reggie says, "Can I ask you one question?" He said, "And listen to how powerful this question is. See, you got to have these people in your inner circle." He said, "Andy, let me ask you a question." There's about 12 people at this meeting. He said, "I want you to imagine that it's the first Sunday. We've just moved in this building. We've just had two worship services. We're done. Everything's gone great. How are you going to feel?" And I'll tell you the first thing that came to my mind, and I said it. I said, "I think I'm going to feel like I wish we'd gone ahead and built the rest of the children's space." An hour later, we added about $3 million to the price of the building. Everybody in the room agreed, and we almost made a really short-sighted decision. But you got one guy who knows how to leverage the power of questions. The right question at the right time from the right person is an extraordinarily powerful tool. And not only do you need to learn to ask them, that's what we're going to spend most of our time on. You've got to find, you don't want a bunch of them or you'll never get anything done, but you need the one or two men or women who are smart, and they're on your team, they're a little bit contrarian, and they know how to lob in those obnoxious questions at the right time, and God uses them, because the right question at the right time from the right person is an extraordinarily powerful thing in any leadership environment. And you will be tempted to avoid those people. And if you're not very secure in your leadership, you'll work hard to keep them out of the inner circle, but you lose. You lose. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about the questions you asked. Roman numeral 1 in your note-taking outline says this: questions accomplish two important things. Actually, they accomplish more than that. We're going to talk about two. Questions accomplish two important things. Letter A, they reveal values. They reveal values. And letter B, they reinforce values. They reveal values and they reinforce values. This is so important. I could just stop with A and B, and this is huge in leadership. When I say they reveal values, the questions you constantly ask tell me what's most important to you. The questions you constantly ask tell me what's most important to you. You can say to your kids all day long, "Honey, I just want you to do your best. I just want you to do your best. I just want you to do your best." But when they get home, if the question is always, "What did you make? What did you make? What did you make? What did you make?" Your stated value may be, "I just want you to always do your best." But your real value is, "I want to see the grade." The questions you ask communicate what's most important to you. And this works for you or against you. Because I promise, if I were to follow you around in your leadership environment, there are questions you constantly ask. And if you don't know what those are, big insight, newsflash, if you don't know what they are, you may be accidentally reinforcing values you don't want reinforced in your organization. The questions you constantly ask reveal what's most important to you. And the questions that the people around you ask reveal what is most important to them. This is extraordinarily important, okay? Because you're constantly asking questions, and if you ask the wrong questions, or if you're in a leadership environment and you've got a list of stated values over here, and you don't ever ask any questions associated with your values, your questions are always, "How many and how much? How many, how much? How many, how much? How many, how much?" Well, then your mission is more and more and more. I mean, that's your mission, regardless of what your stated values might be. Your values reveal, questions reveal your values. And then secondly, because they reveal values, they become an incredibly important tool in reinforcing values. The two best ways to reinforce values in your organization is by the questions you ask and the stories you tell. The questions you ask and the stories you tell. Now, here's what we did, and I recommend this. This would not take you much time. This has been extremely helpful to us. Once we established our values for our church, We have the value, and then we have a little sentence that describes the value. And then the final touch is we added a question to every single value. Because you couldn't list your values, and it's hard to talk about values sometimes, and you certainly can't remember the definition to all your values. But if you can remember the questions that you've associated with each of your values, then every time you're with staff, every time with you're with your congregation or your core leaders, you just keep coming back to those questions. And every time you ask those questions, you reinforce what's most important in your organization. One of our values in our church has to do with community, about, you know, authentic community. And the question is, are you in a group? Now, it's one thing to talk about authentic community, but it's real clear. Are you in a group? One of our values is scriptural authority. Boy, that's high and lofty scriptural authority. The Bible is the blah, 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 blah. But let me just ask you this. Are your priorities consistent with Scripture? See, a question associated with a value is more penetrating and has more impact than the value itself. You need to attach a question to every value because questions reveal values and questions reinforce values. This is why, and some of you heard me talk about this before, on Monday morning we have an all-staff meeting. Every Monday there's 180 to 200 people in there from both campuses. And every Monday morning, you know, 3 to 4 Mondays a month, my staff hears me ask this one question. I open the meeting with this question. What happened yesterday? That would be Monday, Sunday, because this is meeting on Monday. What happened yesterday or last week that made you feel like you've been successful in your mission to lead people into a growing relationship with Christ? Tell me what happened. Every single week, my staff hears me ask that question. Do you know what they think is important to me? That they've been successful and personally and being involved in the mission of leading people in a growing relationship with Christ. And then you know what we do for 30 minutes? We tell stories. And every time somebody tells a story that hangs on one of our values, I stop and ask that question or make the point, hey, this person's actually doing what we've talked about doing right here. Because the best way to reinforce values is to tell stories and to ask questions. The questions you ask reveal what's important to you. The questions you intentionally ask are a way to communicate and reinforce the values in your organization. So if you don't do anything else, you need to go back as you think about the values and say, what is a question that I can begin asking over and over and over and over? Because if you don't intentionally use this principle, you may unintentionally reinforce things that aren't of greatest value. Because if you're a leader, this is huge. If you're a leader, the questions you ask become the marching orders of your staff. Because if I keep asking my assistant over and over and over for the same thing, after a while she's going to just do it automatically because she knows I'm going to ask. And if you ask me the same question over and over and over, every time I see you coming, I'm going to go, oh yeah, he's going to ask me, I better find out. She's going to ask me, I better find out. Questions, they're powerful, powerful things. And if you'll simply take those two statements and run it through the grid of your organization and ask yourself the question, what are the questions I ask that I need to quit asking? And what are the questions that would reinforce my values that I need to begin asking? Then you'll begin to harness the incredible potential and the power of questions. Now, I want to talk to you about 9 what I would think are essential questions. There are more than 9, but these are just questions that I ask all the time in one, you know, shape or form in different environments. And I've divided them into 4 categories: environment questions, organizational questions, staffing questions, and the last one is professional questions. So let's jump in. These first 3 are reviewed from last year. So if you paid attention to last year, we're going to do these quick because I don't want to review, but I just couldn't talk about environmental questions without reviewing these. An environment is basically your ministry environments, and there's 3 questions. Now, let me see if anybody remembers this. Is the context, anybody remember this? Is the context appealing? Awesome. Thank you. That's great. Is the context appealing? What's so funny? That was great. It was on the screen? Oh, that's it. I thought for a moment somebody remembered something I said. How silly of me. Yeah. Is the context appealing? That is, let me just go ahead and give it to you. Is the context appealing? Is the presentation engaging? And is the content helpful? Is the context appealing? Is the presentation engaging? Is the content helpful? Of every single one of your ministry environments, whether it's preschool, students, middle school, high school, small groups, worship service, Wednesday night, you know, whatever deal, of every single environment, you need to put these somewhere, stamp them on people's head, hang them on the bulletin boards, put them in your little notebooks. Of every single environment, these are three questions you got to ask over and over and over. Here's why. Because if you can answer yes to all three of these about any ministry environment, you have yourself a relevant ministry environment. If the context is appealing, that means the room is suited for what's about to happen. If the presentation's engaging, that means whoever is up there presenting, whether it's announcements, music, or preaching, if they've engaged the audience, and if the content is helpful, then it's a win. Somebody, people are going to come back for that. Two out of three are okay. One out of three, they're not going to come back. But of every single ministry environment, you need to attach these three questions. Is the room, is the environment, is the setting appealing? Are the presenters engaging? Not are they smart, not have they been to seminary, not did they come up with the material, but are the presenters engaging? And thirdly, is the content helpful? I'm telling you, you need to take those three questions and you need to drive it through every single ministry environment. You need to train your teachers to ask it, your administrators to ask it, your preschool people to ask it. Everybody needs to be able to walk into an environment. In fact, now it's so much language on our staff that we'll have, you know, we'll be in an environment or we'll take some people to do something or we'll have a guest speaker and I'll hear the staff the next day saying, wasn't helpful. He was really funny. It wasn't helpful. Or, you know, that was helpful. That was helpful. Or we'll come out of an environment and say, you know what, you know, the gay was engaging and all that stuff, but we should have done something to the room. We forgot one out of three. Of every ministry environment, you got to ask those three things. Last year, we spent the whole hour talking about that, so you can get the CD from that, get more on that later. Okay, let's jump into these, the new things. Letter B, organizational questions. And I'm so glad Ed talked about what he did a while ago because this sets us up for this one. Number one, there's two organizational questions you got to ask. Number one, Which gauges should we be watching? Which gauges should we be watching? You see, every ministry environment has a dashboard. Your church has a dashboard. Every ministry has a dashboard. And on that dashboard are some gauges that you've got to identify. And you need to answer this question about every single ministry environment. Which gauges should we be watching? What should we be measuring in this environment? First little bullet point, gauges are designed to help you anticipate and avoid breakdowns or avoid a breakdown. Gauges on your dashboard of your car are designed to help you anticipate, something's about to happen. Hey, we need some gas. I need to check the oil. Hey, the engine lights come on. You know, we got to put some more water in the water. You know, gauges help you anticipate and avoid breakdowns. Second one, this will take you some time, but you'll never regret the time on this. Every ministry environment needs to identify three or four gauges. Every ministry environment you have at your church needs to identify what are the three or four gauges that we need to watch. Because if you don't, as a leader, help them identify the gauges, guess which gauge they will always look to and judge their success by? What's the gauge? What is it?
Numbers,
right. Hey, it was a great Sunday in student ministry. We had 20 more than last week. Okay, that's great. If that's the only gauge you've given them, and that's the only gauge they're talking about, that's the only gauge you get. You don't want a car with one gauge. If you don't help your leaders determine the gauges they need to be watching, then here's what happens. They will listen to the questions you ask. They will set the one or two gauges they discern or assume from the questions you ask, and you set yourself up for conflict. Now, here's why this is so important. You see, if you'll sit down with your key people, and we're in the process of redoing this at North Point because when we went to two campuses, we realized we need a new dashboard. We need some new gauges to watch. All of a sudden, we have different kinds of things we need to be watching. So we're in the process of redoing this. But here's the deal. If you sit down with your key leaders and you have a discussion with them about, with this question, what are the gauges we need to watch in middle school? What are the gauges we need to be watching in children's ministry? What are the gauges we need to be watching in small groups? What are the gauges we need to be watching in worship service attendance? If you have that discussion and you come to the conclusion together on two or three or maybe four gauges, guess what you've done? Now, this is so important. You have just helped them understand your expectations for what they do. Because if you don't help them determine those, they will go off and define success for themselves in a vacuum. And they may spend a lot of time and a lot of your money being successful. And you call them in and say, I don't think things are going too well. And they're going, you're kidding. See, if you don't get on the same page in terms of what success is, there's going to be conflict. And if you have the discussion, okay, in preschool, let me tell you what I think the gauges are. What do you think the gauges are? Let's don't have 10. Nobody wants to watch 10 gauges. But what are the three or maybe four things we need to be constantly monitoring in this environment? If you don't help your leaders establish that, or if you don't think it through, you're not going to manage expectations very well. You need to determine what are those gauges. The last bullet point, the correct gauges allow you to monitor health as well as growth. The correct gauges allow you to monitor health as well as growth. Here's a few that everybody kind of monitors the attendance gauge. The leader-student ratio gauges. You see, if you start having a breakdown in your middle school, or you start having a breakdown or attendance drop in an area, oftentimes, immediately you start scrambling around, and what's wrong? It must be the leader. You're not doing a good job. It must be the programming. And oftentimes, those train wrecks could be avoided if we were watching the gauges, the early indications that things are out of whack. See, a very important gauge for most of what we do is the student-leader ratio. There are some small group environments that if you overload the teacher, it decreases the quality of what happens in the classroom. Kids aren't going to come back. And if the only gauge you're watching is attendance and suddenly the attendance drops off, you call your leader in and say, hey, what's the deal? But you see, if somebody can come in 6 months ahead of time and says, you know what, I'm watching the leader-student ratio gauge, and we're getting dangerously close to the red line. I know we're still growing, but you know what? We got to pull over and do something. We're not training enough leaders to sustain the growth we're now incurring. See, that's a warning. Now you can do something about it. Another gauge that we watch in our small group ministry is the relationship between leaders in adult small groups and apprentices. We know today how many apprentices we need as it relates to how many leaders we have and how many groups we're leading. The leader-to-apprentice ratio is something we have to watch in small group ministry. There's some stuff about that in the book. But you need to sit down and ask, what are the specific gauges in each ministry environment we need to watch? Staff to budget. For us, we have a ministry, some of you have a similar thing called Starting Point. And this is for people who come in asking questions. They're new Christians, non-Christians. They don't know what they are. They're ripping the cellophane off their Bible saying, what page do I turn to? I mean, they're starting, okay? One of the gauges we have to watch is what percentage of people that go through Starting Point actually make it to a small group after that. We want to know that ratio. See, that's part of our success. We want to keep our eye on that. So our small group ministry, that's one of the gauges that they watch on their dashboard. I'm just telling you. The people that you lead are looking at some gauge. If you haven't had the conversation, you're not helping them manage your expectations, and you have not helped them define success for themselves. And in every ministry environment, you need two or three or maybe four engages that you've agreed to, that they're able to look, track, turn in a report every month, or sit down with you at any time and say, we're doing okay here, we're kind of in the red here, we're doing great here, trouble's coming here. Hey, Pastor, I just want to warn you, you said no to the budget, I understand that, but I'm just telling you, we're about to move into the red, and you got to help me figure this out, because I'm watching the gauges. If you walk into the environments, things look great, but I'm telling you, trouble's coming, because look at this ratio, look at this relationship, look at this trend line. You got to have those gauges. Otherwise, you can't manage expectations and you can't help establish what is success for your different ministry environments. The second one under organizational questions is this. This is huge. In fact, if your senior pastor isn't here, this is going to help you, okay? This is going to help you a lot. If you're in a ministry and you're doing something you don't really want to do and don't like doing, but they've made you do it, here is your ticket, okay? Here's the question. Ready? Where are we manufacturing energy? Where are we manufacturing energy? Where are we manufacturing energy? In other words, where are we pretending to be excited about something we're not really excited about? Where are we promoting something that, to be honest, I don't really even want to go to it? You ever have to do that? See, that was the great thing about being on staff at a church that had adult Sunday school. I didn't have to go because I was busy. Everybody needs to be in Sunday school, and I can't go. Preacher can't go. Music director can't go. None of the choir can go. But it's important. Everybody needs to go except the preacher, the music director, the youth pastor, most of the staff, the guys smoking in the parking lot, and the people parking cars. But everybody else needs to be in Sunday school, and the only people that ever promoted adult Sunday school were people that never went. That's what you call manufacturing energy. This is a very important question. Where are we manufacturing energy? That is, where are we having to kind of drum up some excitement about something? And to be honest, I don't know. I mean, we used to be excited about that, but it's just, you know, it's had its day. This past fall on our leadership team retreat, we asked that question. I said, come on, let's think across the board, all the way across the board. Where are we having to manufacture energy? And we decided an area at North Point where we were having to manufacture energy with membership. That every time I got up to say, you really ought to join because then you'll be a member. Let's get right on that, Martha. I hadn't thought about that. If we join, then we'll be a member. I'm motivated. Are you motivated? And we all admitted, membership's important, but every time we talk about it, it's just, you know, we're having to, you really need to join the church. There was just no energy there. Let me tell you what. That was a very important discovery. Because I don't want anybody on my paid staff to have to pretend. And I don't want anybody to have to do what I used to do to get up and announce things and talk about things that you weren't even sure you believed in. I want zero of that. So every once in a while, you have to ask the question, where are we having to manufacture energy? About a year ago, our singles guy came in. He said, Andy, I'll tell you what we're manufacturing energy. We had this thing on Sunday nights, every other Sunday night for singles called Area Fellowships. We've been doing it for 9 years. He said, I got to be honest. It's okay, but it's not great. He said, when we talk about it with our leaders, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, that. It's not broken. I mean, I don't even hear anybody complaining about it, but there's just not a sense of exhilaration. He said, is it okay if we do away with them? I said, absolutely. Kill it. Let's don't drag it into the next, you know, century just because it worked for 9 years for us. You know, they killed it. Came out with a new ministry environment called Fusion. When they launched Fusion, hundreds more singles immediately appeared in our church. You know why? Because we decided we're not going to manufacture energy. If we have to manufacture energy, let's just don't do it. Life is too short for that. Underneath that, I put, if something's not working, I bet you can fill in these blanks yourself. Of course, they already gave it to you, didn't they? Yeah. If something's not working, fix it or kill it. If something's not working, fix it or kill it. Don't maintain it. Don't continue to ignore it. And you know what the best way to fix most things in a church is? Kill it. That's the best fix for most things. Just go ahead and kill it. See, dead things that you don't bury, what happens to them? They what? They stink, right? And you don't want to spend money. You don't want to spend. See, all, you know what? Come on. Most of you could get a raise if you ask this question. Because your church would end up doing away with so much stuff, you'd have all this extra money. Right? If it's not working, and let me say this, and we need to come back some of you and just talk about this. When I say if something's not working, fix it or kill it, and the best way to fix it is to kill it. See, what happened with our singles ministry, and what we've seen happen in many environments, is as things start to peak, and we're asking the question, where are we having to create energy? You know what? We're having to fake it a little bit. We're having to pretend a little bit. I'm up there talking about it, but I'm not convinced. And they're just, you know, there used to be when we talked about this, there was like it was breathtaking. And now it's kind of like, oh yeah, don't forget to come to the thing. You know, you're just, it's just not there. Let me tell you what, one of the best things you can do is just go ahead and do away with it while it's working. And then launch something new. In fact, I tell guys who are trying to transition churches all the time, I'm telling you, I say, you know what? You got to do this. If you're in a church and you're trying to transition it, here's how our pastors are saying, you know, somebody, in fact, you may be in this situation, somebody's trying to hire you, and they're saying, look, you know, we've been traditional, but we want to be contemporary. You know, we want to be fellowship church and come in here and help us do that. And you know they're lying, you know. Or they mean it, but they don't know. You know, I say, here's the litmus test. Go in there and say this, okay? I think this is a great idea. We need to transition this church. So are you willing to shut down the church for 6 months and start over, relaunch in 6 months? No. See, if you're not willing to kill it, you're not really willing to fix it. Try that. Just say, look, let's just shut down. I mean, we'll still meet, but we'll meet on Sunday night. We'll take the board. We'll take the sign down. We'll make every... Let's let the place go dark. And let's meet secretly, like in the first century. Anybody got a catacomb in their backyard or a cellar? We'll meet secretly, and then let's relaunch like a church plant in 6 months. See, when you find a group of people willing to do that, they're willing to fix it because they're willing to kill it. And so you got to ask the question. Where, this is a question, you got to ask it every year, you got to ask it in every ministry environment. Where are we manufacturing energy? As my, I said in my notes, where am I pretending to be excited about something? What event do I continue to promote, but the truth be known, I don't even want to go there either. If you, again, let me go back. If your senior pastor's not here, your boss is not here, here's how to apply this. You need to go back and sit down with them and at some point say, look, here's an area of my ministry. You know, it was here before I got here. I know you didn't, you know, inherited it and your predecessor inherited it. But I'm having to manufacture energy for that. I'm having to pretend. Do you want me to pretend? You don't want me to pretend. You need to talk about this. And let me just, if you're the leader, one last thing on this. This is huge. Let me just tell you what. Real leaders won't stick around. Real, good, authentic, solid, you got to have them leaders, won't stick around in a ministry where they are expected to manufacture energy. We hate it. I mean, you know what? You're a leader. You hate that. You just can't stand to get up and talk about something you're not excited about. And so if you want to keep your good leaders, you got to kill it, fix it, slash just kill it. Otherwise, your good leaders are going to leave because nobody wants to spend their life and time and money maintaining something they don't even really believe in. And every church, our church, Fellowship Church, your church, every church in different seasons is going to outgrow ministries. You're going to outgrow things. Let's not do what we've complained about the previous generation doing, all right? Let's don't drag dead stuff along with us. Let's just kill it and bury it. Start new things. And the way you start that conversation is you ask, not what's broken and what's not working, no. What you ask is there anywhere we're having to kind of just manufacture energy? All right, staffing questions. Letter C. You're going to hate this. Not the first one. The first one's good. Second one's not. First question. And these are so big. I'm sorry to take so much time on each one. Who needs to be sitting at the table? Who needs to be sitting at the table? Whose input do you need to make the best decision possible? Who are the initiators and the completers in your organization? I call this the Joseph principle. See, Potiphar was smart. Potiphar had slaves. Potiphar had managers. He had middle managers. Potiphar had an army. Potiphar in Egypt, he had everything he needed. I mean, he had layers of stuff. And then there was Joseph. And Joseph was at the bottom of the totem pole. But he's noticed something about this guy. This guy can get the job done. And I know Frank's been with me for 12 years. And I know Barbara's been on my management team since the beginning of the church. And I know Phyllis over here, you know, she's related to the rich guy and she comes to meetings and she's on the deal. And I know I got all these people around me that have been around me forever, but good grief, that guy can get it done. And Potiphar was smart. He said, excuse me, y'all. This is your new boss, Joseph. And what happened? The Bible says everything in Potiphar's household prospered. Why? Because Potiphar was smart enough to know there's a get-it-done guy. He's at the wrong place in the organization. We're bringing him up, but he's only been here a week. I don't know, but look what he's done in a week. The stables are cleaner than they've been ever clean. He named all the horses, and, you know, it's just wonderful. But Potiphar, he's not one of us. Jewish. I know, but the guy can get it done. He's your boss. Okay, now here's my point. Here, listen. And this is not easy. This is not easy. When you're sitting around with the people that are making the decisions, you as a leader, you have to have the right people at the table. It does not matter where they are in your organization. That is irrelevant. The most important thing to do for your organization is to make the best decisions possible. And if you are a slave to your hierarchy, and if you are a slave to something you put in place, you got to change it or fix it or break it or start over. But when you sit down to make the big decisions, you got to have the right people at the table. If people get their feelings hurt because they've been there 8 years and this guy's been there 8 minutes and you bring him in, then they just got to get over it. But do not hamstring your leadership based on rank and based on who's been there longer. You just can't do that. In fact, Lane Jones, one of our management team guys, is here, one of our executive staff. We've been together since the beginning of North Point, and he would tell you, I was thinking today, Lane, I don't even remember when we've had an executive staff meeting with just the executive staff. I can't even remember the last time, because I'm constantly bringing people in from different levels in the organization and putting them in that meeting because I want their brain at the table. And I know I've hurt some people's feelings, and I know there have been people who have been there much, much longer than these people I bring in. We just hired a new service programming director for our satellite campus. She's in her late 20s. And I've known her since she was in high school, and I was so glad we hired her. And as soon as we hired her, I said, Sandy, I want you at the table for the next 6 months. She's going, really? I mean, I just joined the staff. I said, I know. I want your brain. I want your input. I got to have you at the table. I mean, we just went right down to the bottom and took the most newly hired person we had and stuck her at the highest level in the organization for a few months. She's not part of the management team. I didn't give her a raise. I didn't escalate her in the organization. I just put her at the table. You got to have the right people at the table at the right time, because what Ed said earlier, the way you lead in a great way is you ask the right people the right questions, and sometimes at the right time. And you got to have the right people there in order to ask the questions. So don't let the hierarchy in your organization keep you. In other words, people say, well, Andy, how many pastors do you have? We don't even use that terminology. I have no idea how many pastors. We don't even use that. How many direct reports do you have? It's not even relevant. When it's time to sit down and meet, depending on what we're going to talk about, I scoop them up from everywhere, because I got to have the right people. And you know what my staff has learned? They've learned you just get over that. Andy's not trying to be fair. Just remember this. This is important. This is so important. Repeat after me. This will help you. Fairness ended in the garden. Fairness ended in the garden. That'll come in handy. Since the Garden of Eden, nothing has been fair. It is a pipe dream. It's not even a goal. Don't even try it. Okay? God can't even be fair because of sin. Just think about that. That'll get you going for a while. Okay. Who needs to be sitting at the table? Okay, enough of that. And one last thing on this. Okay, after about 5 years, if you have a management team or leadership team or executive team or whatever you call them, after 5 years, you got to mix it up. You got to mix it up. 5 years is about it. Everything I've read in business, 5 years, you got to have new faces, new voices, new perspective. It just gets stale. And you go, but Andy, let me just say this. My leadership team has been with me from the first day we opened North Point Community Church. There were six of us. For 9.5 years, we've been together. But they'll tell you, I do not let my love for them or my friendship with them hamper me from getting the right people in the right meetings, on the right retreats at the right time. You just can't allow yourself to be stuck with hierarchy. The goal is to make the right decisions, not keep everybody on the staff happy. Okay. Staffing questions. Who needs to be sitting at the table? And every time you have a different situation, different decision, you got to ask. Don't just say, call in the management team. No. Okay. Who needs to be at this meeting? Get the right people at the table. Okay, number two, this is the tough one. Who's not keeping up? Who is not keeping up? This is staffing now. Who is not keeping up? And as soon as I ask you that question, somebody came to mind, didn't they? This is the question you don't want to ask. Who is not keeping up? This is the most painful question to ask. Who's not keeping? Who's been promoted past their competency? Who was a number one ace when there were 300 people in your church, but now there's 600 and they're not keeping up? You owe it to yourself, everybody else on staff, and the person who comes to mind, ask that question. Let me free you. Okay, listen. It is not honoring to work around somebody. You know how I know that? Because if you found out in your organization somebody was working around you, that you weren't cutting it, you weren't keeping up, they were just kind of working around you, you would not go home and say, I'm so grateful. You would not feel grateful. You would feel dishonored. It is dishonoring to work around somebody who's not keeping up. The most honoring thing you can do for them is to set them free. You are wasting their time and their life. And I'm talking like, you know, this is easy. And if you work for me, I just go in there and say, you're out of here. No. I always make these decisions too late because we love people. But you owe it to yourself and your organization and everybody in it to ask this question periodically. Who's not keeping up? Somebody in your organization already knows the answer to this question. He or she is wondering if you do. You see, the other people in your organization know she's not keeping up. They just wonder if you know. And as soon as you let her go, they're going to come to you and say, that was a good move. We were wondering if you were ever going to make it. Not because we don't love her. I mean, you know, pay her salary for 8 years. I don't care. Pay for the rest of her life. Just move her out of the organization. Okay, now this is important. We'll come back and talk about this someday. Don't you dare mix business with benevolence. Don't hire a ministry, have a ministry. Don't marry a ministry, have a ministry. Okay? If you said, oh, but she's a single mom, okay. Buy her a car, buy her a house, give her a pension, support her the rest of her life. But don't hamper the organization. Don't mix business with benevolence. You know what happens? You don't get the best of business because they don't do their job. You don't get the best of benevolence because you start to resent the fact you're paying her for something she's not doing, or you're paying him for something he's not doing. You got to ask the question, who's not keeping up? And Good to Great by Jim Collins, he asked these two great questions. This isn't in your notes. You got to read that book if you haven't read it. Good to Great. Here's what he says. Here's two questions to ask if you're wondering if somebody's not keeping up. Now, I hate to even ask you these questions because immediately you're going to know. These are great questions. Number one, would you hire this person again? There you go. Number two, if he or she quit, would you be secretly relieved? If there's anybody in your organization and you would be secretly relieved if they quit, it's like, you're leaving? You know, you throw two parties. Sorry, okay, that was bad. I sound heartless. I'm not. Believe me, if you had tracked me through these decisions, you'd know I'm not heartless. I just know this. We're doing the most important thing in the world. And God loves the people we set free more than we love them. And he took care of them before they got in our organization. He's going to keep taking care of them afterwards. And you know what? We're benevolent people. We are going to release people with better severance packages and more benefits and more love and more grace. It'll be the best time. It'll be the best firing they ever experience in their whole life because we love them, but we love our organization. Who's not keeping up? Okay, we're almost done. Letter D, professional questions. Last two. Where do I make the greatest contribution? You got to ask this of yourself. I'm not asking you about me. Where do you? Okay, you got it. Where do I make the greatest contribution to the organization? Where do you make the greatest contribution? You know what? You got to ask that over and over and over because it might change. Where do you make the greatest contribution? And then what do you have to do? You know the answer to this. What do you have to do once you know where you make the greatest contribution? You got to move more and more and more of your time into that area. And the more time you move into the area where you make your greatest contribution, the more successful you become and the more margin and the more space you create for other people to do what they're best at. We've talked about that here before. But you got to constantly ask that question. Where do I make the best, the greatest contribution to this organization? And that will change as your organization grows. Because as you've heard me say before, you know, the less you do, the more you accomplish. And the bigger the organization is, the less you do. I guarantee you, Ed does far less now than he's ever done at Fellowship. I do far less now than I've ever done at North Point. I'm busy, but I do fewer things. And so every year I sit down with Diane and I ask this question and the next one, which is, let me go ahead and give you the second one. What should I quit doing? This is the question that Diane and I talk about two or three times a year in a real serious sit down, look at the calendar way. What do I need to quit doing? What do I need to hand off? What do I need to give up? What do I need to quit doing? Where do I make the biggest contribution to the organization? And what do I need to quit doing? You got to ask it and ask it and ask it and ask it. It changes with every season of ministry. As your organization grows, you have to give up to move up. The more successful you are, the less you will do. You've got to ask this question constantly. Now, let me tell you what I think you should do with all this, okay? These are just questions I ask. Because questions reveal and reinforce values, you got to come up with a list of questions. And I think these are great ones. You can come up with a shorter list. You can come up with a different list. But you've got to constantly ask questions, because questions is how you leverage your influence, listen, at every level in the organization. At every level in the organization, questions is how you leverage your influence as a leader. And because you're a leader, people take your questions seriously. And because you're a leader, your questions set the direction and the expectations for what happens in all of your ministry environments. So one of the best things you could do coming out of this conference, because we've been talking about questions all day, is to ask the questions, what am I asking, what do I need to ask? What have I been asking, what do I need to ask? What have I been asking, what do I need to ask? How do I, maybe you shape a whole retreat around determining the gauges. Maybe you sit down with your management team for a whole day and talk about, what are the questions we need to associate with each of our values? You sit down with your management team and you ask them this great question, you know, Frank, where do you think you make the greatest contribution to this organization? What do you need to quit doing? Sandy, where do you think you make the greatest contribution? What do you think you need to quit doing? And then here's the question I ask our staff constantly. This is a good one. How can I help? How can I help? As to say, hey, you know, I have the most resources, I have the most influence. How can I help? Because I value your success in this organization. Questions are a powerful tool in the hands of a leader. You got to have somebody who's asking the tough ones, and then you need to be in a position where you're asking the questions you need to ask to reinforce the values that you need reinforced. All right, this time, he's here. Ed's going to come up, and we're going to arm wrestle, and then we're going to be dismissed. Would you please welcome Ed Young?
Thanks, Andy. That was incredible. Andy Stanley. Andy, sit down, man. We're going to sit down just for a second. We only have a couple of minutes. But Andy, I want to ask you a couple of questions. All of us communicate. Tell me, what are some questions you ask yourself in putting together and crafting a talk?
That's a great question, Ed. One of the first questions is, what is the tension I want to create? Because adults learn, this is huge, adults learn on a needs-to-know basis. It's pointless to have evangelism classes if they're not doing evangelism. Adults learn on a needs-to-know basis. So in a message, I'm answering a question. If they're not asking the question, if they're not asking the question that we're answering, then it's irrelevant. So the question is, what specifically is the tension I want to set up at the beginning of a message?
For example, like what's something you've done recently where you think you've done a great job at that tension?
We're doing a series right now called Breakaway, and the tension of this series is, after a while, life starts to look and feel the same. Next Christmas kind of be like last one. Next summer is kind of like last summer. Gee, all of a sudden, and in our culture says the only way to break away from being just another pack, you know, cow and the herd and sheep and the goat, you know, it's just everybody's doing the same thing. We all want the same things. You know, everything looks the same after a while. We're not unique. And culture says the only way to break away is to run away. You know, get a new family. Get a new wife. Go find, look up your old girlfriend. Stay out late dancing, leave your husband at home. You know, sail around the world. The only way to break away from being normal is to run away. And the scripture says, no, you can break away where you are and life can be different. Well, everybody that's thought about looking up their old girlfriend's like, yeah. And everybody who's tried to break away by running away and is back going, that didn't work, they're going, yeah. And so just that tension of, gee, I don't want to be part of the crowd. So anyway. And so that's a 6-week.
Okay, how about illustrations, Andy? You preach a lot from your life, teach a lot from your life. How do you, as you live life, do you just say, hey, there's an illustration, I'm going to talk about that? I mean, do you just know it?
I listen to your CDs and then take them to the next level. That's what I try to do.
I know. Man, I've been just hammered by you and Ben. Man, but how do you do that, though?
How do I improve on
your
messages?
Yeah, I mean, how do you craft illustrations? Do you know when they happen? I'm going to use that, or do you just as you're
I'm studying, they usually just, you know, pop up. I don't have like a catalog or a file or an illustration book.
You're kidding me. No, you don't?
No.
So find yourself, though, usually relying on the personal illustrations and the biblical illustrations?
Yeah,
because you're such a great storyteller. And the whole thing about Joseph, as you did that with Potiphar, and then when you speak, I know you utilize that and the personal. So you would say, when it comes to illustrations, those are the big two, the biblical illustration
and personal.
The personal.
I think that's, I never thought about it that way, but that's it. I mean, if your illustrations won't work for me, I resort to biblical and personal. Sorry.
Have you gone through? I've never asked you this question. Have you gone through a metamorphosis as a communicator?
Yes.
Your father being a great speaker. Tell us definitely about that, because I kind of shared that a little bit about my life. I want to hear it from you.
I think in the last maybe even 4 years, I have again. I think one of the great things about communicating right now. It's not necessarily a good trend, but it's reality. Mm-hmm. And this is just a sidebar. Don't ever be against culture. That's really a waste of time. That's like spitting into the wind. I hate the wind. Oh, God. You know, it's culture, right? Yeah. Culture is a wind, and you harness it or it knocks you down. So Jesus harnessed it. We're supposed to harness it. So that's a little screwy at times because you think, oh, no. Anyway, so going back to your question. In our culture, nobody's asking what is true. Everybody's asking what works. So in traditional preaching, and the way I grew up and the way I started preaching was, here's truth, you know, here's truth, here's an illustration, here's an application, let's close in prayer. I flipped the whole thing around now. I usually don't get to the truth till the end, because here's the deal. See, what God has given us works.
Yes.
So I start with, it works, this works. Oh, yeah, but guess what? It's in the Bible. Or I say, you know what? Okay, since we know this is true and since we know this is work, I say, if you were God, in light of what we've just seen, in light of what we've experienced, what would you say about this topic? Oh, that's exactly what he said. So you just turn it around. And I think because people are asking what works as opposed to what's true, you start with what works and work toward what's true. And you lead people in the journey that way. And that's a very important trend, I think, in culture. But that's not how we were raised to preach.
That's the truth. That's the truth. Talking about culture, what is your take on the whole postmodern thing? Did you guys ever wonder about that postmodernity? Andy, what is it, man?
Let me, just in a simple sentence, clarify for everybody postmodernism. I know there's been books written on it, but I can, one simple sentence, I think it just means after modern. Post is after.
Yeah. Yeah.
After modern. But I would say this.
Yeah.
I would say this.
Okay.
You don't need to be afraid of postmodern.
No.
You don't need to be afraid of anything. Hey, if the whole world's postmodern, we go, all right. We'll just start there. I mean, we're Christians, we freak out. And you and I came out of the late 70s where the Christians were freaking out about everything. We're against everything. You know, no wonder nobody listened. We were against everything. And so if everything becomes postmodern, it's all right. You're going to eat and live indoors and, you know, go on. I mean, just think when Jesus started, you weren't even allowed to be a Christian. I mean, you were way ahead of the first century. So we don't need to fear the world being postmodern. If everything's you know, there's no absolute truth, okay, let's just start there. The question isn't how do we keep people from being that way. The question is, if that's where people are, then let's start there. And that way we're always relevant. You harness culture.
Yes.
You don't have to be against culture. It's stupid.
It is stupid.
Yeah.
So you harness that. So, Andy, what are some things in this movement with the whole postmodern movement? What are some things, some strong points, some strengths about it? Also, what do you see maybe as some weaknesses? Because anytime you see a movement like that, you can see some pros and cons.
I tell you one of the greatest strengths. I'll give you a great example. We, in our community group, our groups meet for a year to 18 months, then multiply at our church. And so we have a new group we started this fall. It's all families from a baseball field where our kids play baseball. So not only is it a small group, but it's all families that we play baseball with. Two of the families are new to North Point. One family doesn't go to church anywhere, hasn't ever gone to church anywhere, raised in Catholic homes. Both parents had bad experience. So they are like totally unchurched and know nothing about the Bible. And they're in our small group. Now, why would you get in a small group with the preacher And you don't even know anything about the Bible or God or go to church. It's because community is such a high value because it works.
Yes.
I mean, these people said they're going to come to our house every Monday for a year. They don't even know what we believe. They don't care. Oh, yeah, me, we get to be with some couples we know. And this is what they said. They say, we need that. See, they're committed to community before conversion. And what the great thing is, they're in our group 3 months. We never invited them to church because they expect that. And so the Sunday before Christmas, they called us that Saturday night, said, hey, we're thinking about coming to church. They've been in church every week since. They know nothing about the Bible. See, that's a great thing. If people aren't worried about truth, then truth doesn't get in the way of you inviting them into community. The dangerous thing is they're not converted. They're not believers. If you get too many of those, you know, things start to rock the other way, you know. So you don't want six couples like that in your community group unless it's an evangelism group. So I think it's a great trend. But even if it's a bad trend, you say, okay, that's where we are. We start there. We design systems around it.
Yes.
Jesus still rose from the dead. As long as he still rose from the dead, everything's cool. And, you know, that's the only thing I know for sure. And then you move from there, you know.
That's good.
You don't have to be afraid. I'm listening to radio the other day. I hate Christian radio, except your program, of course, and my dad's. And your dad's, those three programs.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And this guy just wailing away on postmodern. Uh-huh. I'm thinking, why are you talking about that? You know, it's like this enemy. So, fear not. Hey, our Savior rose from the dead.
Yeah.
We don't have to be afraid of anything.
That's right.
You know? Yeah, okay.
Come on with it. So, harness it.
Harness it.
Use it. Leverage it. Yeah.
And of course, we know what the downside of culture is. And hopefully we're smart enough, you know.
Okay.
Be fashionable, but, you know, make sure everything's covered up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So. Right?
Uh-huh. This guy is like Jerry Seinfeld, isn't he? He's a Christian Jerry Seinfeld. Unbelievable. I think what else I can ask you, Andy? I could talk to you all day.
It would have helped if I'd known before you came out,
that's all
Ed,
right.
But that's okay.
And I like that shirt. That shirt is cool. It looks good on you.
How many of you are here when Ed made me wear his shirt? Yeah, a few down.
You know what?
Row.
It'd be interesting, Andy. How many of you, this is your first time to ever come to a C3 conference, your first time?
Wow. No wonder they didn't know the answer to the questions last week. I know.
No wonder.
I was about to get out of preaching. Nobody remembered anything.
It's worth the DVD several years ago to see when we matched each other with our outfits. That's worth the DVD.
He had this shirt that he got from the women's department at Neiman Marcus. I'm not kidding. Didn't you? Is your wife here? Wasn't it from the women's department? It had like sparkles.
No, come on.
He could wear it because he's cool. Then he made me wear it when I look like I put on something from the women's department of Neiman Marcus.
Andy, to me, you look like Spider-Man. Remember that? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was good. Spider-Man.
Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. We got 7 minutes, Ed.
I know, seven minutes. Andy, what's your next theory?
Let me ask you a question.
Oh, no.
What's your take on the whole postmodern thing?
I think it's great. I think, like you said, harnessing culture, I like using the arts and preaching kind of that homiletical plot thing that we talked about
and
earlier between the sessions where you introduce a topic, a thought, and then, as you said, you don't maybe answer the question until later. You build that tension you know, about the table and things like that we did. Some of that stuff I think really, really connects. But I think the danger of it is that relativism can infiltrate the church and our theology. And as you said,
it's okay.
But the danger is you have to give answers. We have to give truth, and you can't just leave everything open ended. And Lee Strobel told me one time, he said, you know, that's why I became an atheist, because I grew up in a church that never said, okay, this is true, and you
this
know,
is right, this
yeah,
is wrong.
Yeah,
and
right.
You know what's great? The clearest postmodern statement in the Bible, somebody asked a question to Jesus.
Yeah.
Anybody remember what it was? Start with the P. He was a Roman. What is truth?
What is truth?
Yes. What is truth? Oh, you're postmodern. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I don't know.
It is.
So it's not new, and it's okay. Mm-hmm. And that's the environment from which Christianity took off, so we're cool.
What are some more series that you're working on, Ed? Anything?
We're going to do a Lord of the Tsunami, 3 weeks on the tsunami, called Lord of the Tsunami. Mm-hmm. And we're going to tackle it head on and show video and just talk about what are the options. And what's great, Muslims are wrestling with the same apologetic question.
Yes.
You know, where was God, and was it the will of Allah? And mm-hmm. and so we start in 3 weeks, and we're going to just go the Lord of the Tsunami. How do you factor that into Christian theology? And I'm very excited because it's an important question, natural disaster, disaster in general. People are thinking about it. You got all the pictures. And we spend a day like you do with a team just brainstorming through mm-hmm. what are the issues, how do you answer the questions. So I'm very excited about that.
That's great.
Yeah, it's an important topic. So.
That's great.
Hey, we did a cool thing. We took up an offering for the tsunami.
So did we.
Yeah, it was great. It was fun to see people just be that generous right after first of the
yes.
year. It was awesome. So it was cool.
It was. Who all took up an offering for the tsunami? Yeah,
that's great. Isn't that neat?
That's great. That is neat.
Yeah, so
that's
people really given, so it's interesting to talk about it.
Wendy, I know you got to hop on a plane and get back to Atlanta. It's always a pleasure to have you here. Andy, again.
Okay, I guess I'll say one more thing.
Okay.
How long have we known each other? 6 years? I don't know. No, right when we started North Point, so 9 years? We
yeah.
had that retreat.
You know what's funny, Andy? I've never told you this on the serious side. When I met you in Florida that afternoon, I had the most difficult experience in the history of my ministry. And I really believe it was God that brought us together. We had a staff member really, really go south on us at a major, major time at Fellowship.
You were on vacation.
Church. Sure was. Uh huh.
Is that it?
I just want to tell you that. I've never told you that.
I didn't want to interrupt. That
yeah,
was a
no, I heard.
Moment.
You know, I heard all
moment.
About you.
Yeah.
I just, you know, knew you were there. I wanted to meet you, and I just remember that, you know.
But
I kind of remember some crazy things.
You know, Ed had his family up here a while ago. Ed and I and our wives went on a trip for 4 days, 4 nights, 5 nights, to the beach. And, you know, when you spend that much time with a couple, with a marriage, you can tell. And I just want you to know, they're... What you saw is so rock solid. They're both so incredibly secure, and they're just who they are. And it's refreshing because I can say this. You know, you see Mr. Cool Rock Star Preacher, and you're going, yeah, I bet. I mean, I'm like sort of normal, but you're like way out there, you know. People trust me. They're not
yeah.
sure they can trust
uh-huh.
you. And I'm watching some of these guys here that are kind of look more normal like me, watching you and taking notes. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, he is so slick and cool, and that, but I just want you to know. Real deal from head to toe, family inside out have been in their home, and I just love Ed, and I'm just thrilled that you get to send this into it.
Okay, well, hey, you know, Andy, we all work for a good company, man. We all work for a good company.
We do,
and it's all by God's grace and mercy. So, hey, why don't you close us out in a word of prayer, I think that's about it for today, isn't it? Is that it, Troy? Preston, you have a couple more things to say?
Hey, and y'all are going to get to hear Rob Bell. Ooh.
He's awesome. Awesome.
He's incredible.
And Rob's flight made it. He's here.
I know.
So,
right?
Yeah.
He's great. He's back there rewriting his talk after he heard mine, I think. So anyway. Just kidding.
Ooh.
Rob
That's funny.
Knows more about everything than I'll ever know. Let's pray.
Yes.
Heavenly Father, thank you that with all the questions and all the mystery and all the stuff waiting for us back at home and the dysfunction and just the junk, and thank you that today, what we sang a while ago, we sang to the King who's coming again.
Yes. That's right.
Because eyewitnesses saw him after he rose from the dead. We win. Unbelievable.
Yes.
Please find us faithful in the meantime mm-hmm. with our temptations and our sorrows,
right.
with our joys, with our expressions, with our frustrations. Just find us faithful. We long for the day when we either appear in your presence or you appear in ours. We don't really care. We just long for that day. Guide us and direct us in this changing culture. We want to be faithful. We want to be great. We want to be effective. We don't want to waste time or money or talent or effort. So we just plead with you. Just give us all wisdom to know what to do with what we've heard. Thank you for Ed. Please protect him, his family, his ministry, his staff, his children, the children of his staff. Just put your arms around this ministry and continue to lift it up to influence all of us for generations, Father. Thank you for just... Thank you for Fellowship Church, that it's just a place where we all come and find hope and are inspired to go back and be better and do better. In Jesus' name.